Hello, friends. Welcome to episode 4 of the David O. Stewart Show. This month, historian John Ragosta takes us back to July 1776 when Thomas Jefferson began writing the Declaration of Independence. I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show here on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and you can find us on Spotify, iHeart, and Apple Podcasts. Before I leave it over to David, I just want to tell you that John is the inaugural James Madison Fellow at Montpelier. He was previously the interim director of the International Center for Thomas Jefferson Studies at Monticello. And so he is very, very, very well informed to talk about this spectacular moment in time. So over to you, David. Thank you very much for being here, John.
Thank you.
Thanks, Hope. And John, it's a treat to have you here. We're going to put you to work. There's some heavy lifting to be do if we, to do if we're going to talk about the Declaration, which, it's really the American creed. We can all recite at least parts of "All men are created equal, endowed by their Creator with certain inalienable rights, among them life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness." There's no avoiding that, and there is stuff to be said about it. Let me just set the stage a little bit for the events. We left off our viewers in 1775 with Common Sense, and now we're coming to middle of the year, 1776. It's a hot war. The Americans and the British are killing each other. It's getting very ugly. By one count, you could say the score is tied 1-1. We had a terrible invasion of Canada that was a catastrophe. But we did manage to throw them out of Boston and, frankly, to protect Massachusetts for almost the rest of the war. And there were other smaller conflicts around the area. But as you get towards the June and July, the Americans know the British are going to counterpunch. They've been massing their strength up in Nova Scotia, and there are decisions to be made. Can you sort of describe what happened when Richard Henry Lees rises in the Continental Congress early in June?
Well, David, your introduction is so important because it's very easy for us to forget how revolutionary this event was and how contingent, historians like that word, but how really troubled the nation was at that time. And we'll also get to the revolutionary nature of those principles. I want to get to that American mission statement. But the mere act, I mean, Britain is the superpower of the 18th century. And until we really have Thomas Paine's Common Sense in early 1776. People weren't really sure what they're doing. They weren't sure, are we trying to be British citizens? People were talking about independence. But in June and July, they know there's an invasion force coming. And at that time, it's the largest invasion force that Britain's ever sent anywhere. And it has those dreaded Hessians on those ships. And these ships are coming. They're pretty sure they're coming to New York.
Now, one of those Hessians was my ancestors.
Well, he may have been one of the Hessians who decided to stay. A lot of Hessians decided America's not so bad.
Think so.
It was frightening. It was very difficult. Washington is sitting in New York with these untrained troops waiting for the cream of the British Army and the Hessian Army to end up showing up. So when Richard Henry Lee shows up on, I think, June 8th with that resolution, these United Colonies are and of right ought to be free and independent states. It wasn't like that was a new idea. People had been talking about it. John Adams, especially, had been talking about it. But now there is sort of a recognition, we're going to really have to grapple with this. We're going to have to decide. What we're going to be. Are we going to be a nation or are we going to simply be a British colony?
So, what was Congress's reaction? How was their response to Lee?
Well, of course, they're not sure. Now, Lee's resolution, it's important to say, it wasn't just we should declare independence. And I say Lee's resolution, of course, it's coming from Virginia, by far the largest colony. It's important to remember Virginia is almost twice the size of the next largest colony in terms of population. But it calls for independence. It also calls for foreign alliances. And once you start having foreign alliances, you're no longer a British colony. And it also calls for a government that, we can't simply be 13 independent states. That's not going to work really well. Rhode Island is not going to function as an independent nation. So how do we create this nation? And Congress's immediate reaction is, as I said, almost, we need to think about this. So they booed. You're familiar with this. You worked in Washington many years. They punted. And they said, okay, let's appoint committees. That's a good way to push the ball down the road. And they appointed committees to look into these things. And part of that was because there was a recognition that we have to be unanimous on this. And today we say, well, of course, you had to be unanimous. It says right at the top of the Declaration of Independence, a unanimous declaration. But that was an important decision. That no, we're all in this together. And again, we can come back to that as one of the principles of the Declaration. And so they knew they needed some time with some of these colonies. Pennsylvania, New York, weren't quite sure how far they wanted to go. And so by appointing these committees and allowing them to start talking about, well, how would we form a government? How would we form foreign alliances? How would we declare independence? And at night in the taverns, people were talking about, well, what are we going to do next? So it took a little bit of time to mature.
Well, my home state of Maryland was also undecided and didn't come around till very near the end. Appointing committees is still a great tool, or you could call it a dodge. How did they pick the committee members they appointed? Because that's always important.
Absolutely. And they knew, of course, you have to have a Virginian. We know we have to have a Virginian because, again, Virginia is the largest colony, economically the largest colony. It's the king's old dominion after
Well,
a
and
while.
also someone from Massachusetts, because that's
And
where the
absolutely, you have
fighting
to
is
have
going to
someone
be.
from Massachusetts because they're the ones who are fighting. They're the ones who've been in the forefront. They're the radicals of the time. So they were careful about how they appointed these committees. John Dickinson, at that time from Pennsylvania, one of the most famous congressmen of the time, we tend to forget him. He's not comfortable with independence. So he's not put on the independence committee, but he is put on how do we form a government committee? Because, Dickinson's one of the great lawyers of 18th century America. But on the independence committee, they say, okay, we have to have Adams. He's the one who's been shouting and screaming about independence for months. They appoint Franklin, which is an interesting choice. He's the elder statesman. Everybody knows Benjamin Franklin, as becomes evident. He doesn't write these kinds of documents. We have to have someone from New York. So we get Robert Livingston. Roger Sherman gets thrown in from Connecticut. But the Virginian, and it's interesting, where's Richard Henry Lee? Richard Henry Lee is one of the great speakers of the 18th century. He's a great orator, and he was the natural choice. But Lee, his wife was very ill, and so shortly after he delivered his resolution, he goes back to Virginia. So, gee, there's this young, tall, redheaded guy from Virginia, and importantly, Jefferson, who people said Adams said he was very quiet in Congress. But they knew he could write beautifully. They knew, especially from the Summary Review of the Rights of British North America, document he had written in 1774, which had become very popular. He had not intended that for publication, but it got published and people were reading it. And they said, no, this guy is talking a lot of sense. He writes beautifully. So we're going to put Jefferson on this committee as well. Jefferson, oddly enough, Jefferson is petitioning Virginia, saying, send me back to Virginia. I don't want to be here in Philadelphia. I've got business in Virginia. And But he, of course, becomes the key draftsman of the Declaration of Independence.
Well, his mother had just died. He had a wife newly pregnant. His heart was really with the Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was being written as they were meeting.
Right.
And that's what he wanted to do. But,
And the Declaration of the Virginia Constitution. He said, "Boy, I want to help write a constitution." He never does get that chance.
no, he doesn't. And that might have been okay, but we digress. When the committee gets going, we do know that Jefferson ends up holding the pen. Was that a easy decision, or I suspect Dr. Franklin didn't much want to do it. He people
Yes,
had sort of passed that.
right. The story from the movie 1776, which is amusing, but I think also probably pretty accurate. Franklin says, "I don't write that kind of thing. I write little quips and sayings." Adams, I think, realizes that the line is from his diary. He's obnoxious and disliked. He knows that. And so the Virginian Jefferson, again, with that summary view, which is a beautiful document, a lot of historians are aware of that document. Jefferson becomes the obvious choice. Livingston, New York, was still on the fence about independence. So you couldn't have Livingston do it. And Roger Sherman, a very stable, solid kind of guy, but he was not particularly an educated man. Didn't write the kind of eloquent words that Jefferson wrote. So, I mean, this is Jefferson's great strength. He's a fabulous draftsman. He has a way of putting these words in. I refer to it as America's mission statement. I think you used a different phrase, but these words that seize us, that energize us.
Well, and you've already referred to it, but I just want to sort of drive it home. We tend to think of everything that happens in this era in America as, George Washington did this and George Washington did that. There was a very good reason why he wasn't on that committee.
Yes, Washington's a little busy.
Yeah.
He had been made commander in chief of the army a year earlier in June of 1775, and he's in New York waiting for this invasion. So, and Washington again, Washington, we think of him as the general, we think of him as the first president. He's actually a very solid thinker. But he's not a great draftsman. He would not have been a great choice for this committee in any case.
Well, in fact, he always tried to find somebody else to write his stuff because
Yes.
he was very modest about his talents. And I think he was better than he gave himself credit for. But Hamilton and Madison were no slouches, so he picked good friends. How long did Jefferson take to produce the draft? I mean, time was a wasting. The British were moving.
Yeah, we needed, well, again, we needed time to percolate. We needed time to mature. It only took him, I think, about 17 days before he came up with the first draft. But he later says, and this is accurate when you look at the draft, he said, "I wasn't trying to come up with anything new. I was trying to express," he uses the phrase, "the American mind," which I think is actually a very good explanation of what we see in the Declaration and what he was trying to do. He's certainly relying on Locke. He's got Locke's second treatise, Locke's Letter on Toleration. He's got George Mason, the Virginia Declaration of Rights. Clearly, some of the language is coming out of the Virginia Declaration of Rights. And later in life, when people sort of poke at Jefferson a little bit and say, "Well, there wasn't anything original," and Adams being one of the people doing the poking, there wasn't anything original in that declaration. And Jefferson says, "I wasn't trying to be original. I was trying to articulate what it was we were trying to do and what we had been talking about." And that's Jefferson's great strength. As I said earlier, he takes these ideas but drafts them in a way that people can say, "Yes, that's what we want to do. That's what's important."
Just following on, one of the interesting things to me is this was a moment when he could have done a sort of blood-curdling, fierce denunciation, like Thomas Paine would have written, or
Richard Henry Lee might have written
yeah.
that.
And instead, it's not so much that. And let me, or Patrick Henry, give me liberty or give me death. We've done those so far in this series. Why is this an expression of Jefferson's personality, which may be a little bit, or is it just, as you suggest before, he's trying to match the moment?
You know, it's hard to say, David. I think it's some of both. You know, we'll get around to I currently spend my time at Montpelier, James Madison's home, father of the Constitution. The Constitution's very different, and we can come back to that. It's laws, and it's got to say this and that. Jefferson does have a sense for the moment, and he seems to understand that he's writing a document. You know, a lot of historians say it doesn't really become famous until later. I think we tend to minimize looking back how significant this moment was. And Jefferson understands that. He understands this is a very important opportunity. Again, the men are waiting for the British army in New York. One of my favorite moments about the Declaration of Independence, and I think it speaks to what we're talking about. So they vote on the Declaration on July 4th. That evening, they've got John Dunlap, the printer, typesetting by hand and printing out these copies. And we know that there was a rough draft that was sort of screwed up, and they have to fix that rough draft. And they print these copies. Well, there's no internet. They can't fax them. They can't scan them. They put them on horseback and send them around the country. George Washington is sitting with the Continental Army in New York waiting for this invasion when they know they're going to get creamed by 30,000 British and Hessian troops. On July 9th, he tells all of his commanders, his regimental and company commanders, you line the men up and you read them the Declaration of Independence.
Well,
And
good.
what a moment. I mean, what a moment. There are these people, they're farmers, they're amateurs, they're untrained. They're in New York waiting for this invasion, and somebody is standing and reading when in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people. And so that Jefferson language, I think we can easily forget how important it was.
Our listeners should be aware I have a noisy cat, and if you hear him, or her, that's just the way she rolls.
She likes the Declaration too.
She's very engaged in the founding era, as who of us is not. Let's talk though, what was significant to you about his word choices, his tone? How was he, as you suggest, with the soldiers, and also, some people got very fired up over the Declaration when it was read aloud. They had riots in New York City. What were the triggers? What was working?
Well, I think the focus, and there's really two parts to the Declaration. There's the first two paragraphs, which are sort of the principles, which is what we remember. And then there's a list of 27 grievances. The king did this, the king did that. And I think they, in their time, got fired up about both of those. But start with those principles, because that's the beginning of the document. The first line of the Declaration, I'll go through the what I think are the key principles. When in the course of human events it becomes necessary for one people, one people. This is extraordinary. We have people of different religions, different ethnicities, different language, different cultures. And Jefferson's saying, no, we're Americans. We're all one people. E pluribus unum, out of many, one. Again, easy for us to miss how revolutionary this is. In the rest of the world, we knew what made a nation. What made a nation is you're from the same ethnicity, the same religion, the same culture. You're French, you're English, you're Scottish. Jefferson's saying we're one people. Then, you know, at the beginning of the second paragraph, we hold these truths to be self-evident that all men are created equal. And those soldiers standing in line, looking around with these generals wearing their brocade, and they're saying, well, you know, we're going to have all men are created equal. Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. easy for us to, the pursuit of happiness, I think we tend to misunderstand. Well, I'm going to go out and have a great day. I'm going to have a party. That wasn't what they meant by pursuit of happiness. The idea of pursuit of happiness is we all get to participate. We all have a chance in our communities. We all can be elected. We all can vote, the civic virtue. And then that critically important principle, again, so easily forgotten, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. At that time, we knew what government meant. God gave the king power, and then the king ruled over the people. And here, Jefferson in America is declaring, no, the people, that's where the power comes from. So we're not going to have kings. Thomas Paine told us that a few months ago. Here we are in the Declaration saying it. The governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. So, I think, again, we tend to look at these principles. We say, well, of course, that's a standard principle. Well, it wasn't standard at the time. It was revolutionary.
Well, I love how you set that out, but let me just push you back a part that we modern readers sort of gag on, which is that phrase, all men are created equal. It left out a lot of people
Yes.
in terms. Indians, the enslaved women,
And
women
women.
had very few rights. They were quite subordinate and oppressed.
Absolutely. Well, this is one of the troubling things about Jefferson. Anyone who studies Jefferson, how did he keep his head from exploding when he has all these ideas? Here's a man writing, all men are created equal. He enslaves over 600 individuals, including his own children, by Sally Hemings. I guess, David, a couple thoughts. One is he is using the term expansively. And the reason I think we're fairly confident of that is there is a later paragraph, what gets deleted, the paragraph about slavery, where he denounces slavery. And in that paragraph, talking about the enslaved people, he writes all men in capital letters, big capital letters, all men, referring to the enslaved. Now, that tells us a couple of things. First of all, when he says men, he understands there are women who are enslaved. He's got a lot of them back in Monticello. So when he says men, he's using it in a very generic sense. It's men and women. And it's also he recognizes that African Americans are men. They're created equal. Now, how does he live with that contradiction as he continues to enslave people? First of all, I can't answer that entirely. But I do often tell people Jefferson's sight is limited. He sees white men, but his vision is expansive. So the women at Seneca Falls in 1848 are quoting Thomas Jefferson. Frederick Douglass before the Civil War is quoting Thomas Jefferson. Martin Luther King in the 1960s is quoting Thomas Jefferson. So he writes this principle, and he knows we're not living up to it. One of his last letters, Jefferson writes over 19,000 letters in his life, which he's do the math. That's really rather extraordinary. And he doesn't have a typewriter. He's not printing these things. One of his second to the last letter, by most counts, he talks about all eyes are opened or are opening to the rights of man. So he understands we're not there. He understands we're not living up to this principle. He understands that principles are something that you work on. For gosh sakes, we're still working on it. Are we still abiding by all men are created equal? Are we still fully implementing that? So yes, I mean, your question's absolutely a good one. It's at one level an unfathomable contradiction and hypocrisy on Jefferson's part. But on the other hand, he does seem to understand he's writing a document for the ages and, understands it will grow.
Yeah, and it's not an excuse, but I always think of the phrase Patrick Henry used late in his life when he was confronted about this, and he said of slavery, and he had enslaved people on his lands. He said, "I cannot justify it. I will not try." It was convenient. It was what he was used to. And
Absolutely. It's fascinating. You mentioned Patrick Henry. As you know, I've spent a lot of time with Mr. Henry as well. And Jefferson hated Patrick Henry. I think Henry's just a little more honest. I think Henry is, in fact, speaking for Jefferson many times, and including on slavery. Jefferson's just careful about not saying those things in public. He's a much better, careful politician in that regard.
Why do we neglect the Bill of Indictment? I mean, it's most of the Declaration is these grievances.
Right.
And most people don't even know they're there.
Well, yeah, no,
So,
David, it's the second half. In fact, and it's much longer than the half. It's by far the longest part of the document. After you get done with those two paragraphs of principles, 27 indictments. And some historians would say, well, that's really what people focused on at the time. I don't think that's really fair. I think they did care about those principles. And historians will also point out, and one of the reasons we tend to ignore them, you go down that list of 27, a lot of them don't seem to make sense to us. What was that about?
Well, and
Someone will say,
some were not well founded. I mean,
they're
it
not well funded. But the people at the time knew what they were talking about. The
yes.
people at the time said, oh, he's talking about the Gaspee incident. Oh, he's talking about when they, seized the trading ships. But we've tended to forget them. I guess substantively at the time, I would say one thing about then and one thing about now. What was so important about them then was that up until this time, we talked about at the beginning, we weren't really sure what this revolution was and where it was going. And what a lot of people had said was the problem's Parliament. No taxation without representation. We're not represented in Parliament, but the king, he's our king. Americans loved the king, especially after the French and Indian War, and he's our king, and they have images of the king, in their homes, and so on. We celebrated the king's birthday. And Jefferson's summary view of the rights of British North America is actually a plea to the king. Dear king, our king, please save us from this Parliament. And people were talking about, I mentioned John Dickinson's talking about something that's almost like the British Commonwealth, where we'll have our own Congress, but the king will be our king. Well, if you're going to be independent, you got to get rid of the king. Thomas Paine has told us we got to get rid of the king.
He was pretty unmistakable.
And so this indictment at the time, the fact that Jefferson goes through over and over again saying the king did this, the king did that, the king is an enormous shift in not what's coming out of Thomas Paine, we know what he thinks, but what's coming out of Congress is no, it's no longer just Parliament is the problem, it's the king.
Now,
Now, as to why we tend to forget it, we thought all those problems were solved, but I'll leave it to your listeners. You go down that list. He has sent hither swarms of officers to harass our people. He has kept among us in times of peace standing armies, for protecting them from punishments for any murders which they should commit, for cutting off our trade with other all parts of the world, for imposing taxes on us without our consent. People can decide for themselves whether that list of grievances is still relevant.
well, there's the tariffs that come down. There's all the soldiers who are on the streets of Washington and in our metro stations now, who nobody asked for them to be there, and they don't need to be there. So yes, there are some resonances that, which
Yeah.
are worth pointing out. Now, I just want to get back to Richard Henry Lee. I give that man credit for going to t look after his ailing spouse. That was the right thing to do. But did he get back in time to vote? And did he ever express regret that he'd sort of missed this great moment?
No, he doesn't live long enough to realize that he's one of those forgotten founders in many respects. Historians certainly are familiar with Richard Henry Lee, and he's very important. He's an enormously important member of the Congress, as is the whole Lee family. I mean, he's got a
Sure.
brother over in Paris, he's got a brother over in London. His Henry,
Oh,
is
Light Horse Harry, yeah.
Light Horse Harry is in the military. Of course, Light Horse Harry's son is Robert E. Lee. So the Lees of old Virginia, as they say. But does he ever express regret? Lee dies, as I recall, sometime early in the 1790s, and had a very successful career. But he doesn't, as you imply, he doesn't really get much credit for any of this. We tend to forget him. He has a great song in the musical 1776, but other than that.
Sometimes that's all you get. Now, you have alluded to the fact that over time, you push back on the notion that the Declaration was not significant at the moment, but it maybe was not the mission statement or creed that we view it now. When did that sort of religious view of the Declaration really take root?
Well, it develops over time. Some historians point out, by the way, and maybe it develops over time different for different people. African Americans, enslaved African Americans who are hearing it immediately, I mean, immediately, Lemuel Haynes and others, that all men are created equal. And they start writing letters and they start writing petitions.
Right.
So they understand, wait a minute, the significance of this.
Well, they bring lawsuits, right?
They bring lawsuits in Massachusetts, the Quock Walker case, and various cases. Other people, it develops somewhat over time. We shouldn't lose the immediate impact. You had mentioned the riots. I mean, after the soldiers heard this read, they went and tore down the statue of King George in New York. You know,
They got the point.
they were so wrapped up in it. But for other people, it does become somewhat political because keep in mind at the time, they weren't advertising this was Thomas Jefferson's draft. And people in Congress knew that, but the general public didn't know this was written by Thomas Jefferson. So in the 1790s and the early 19th century, the first decade of the 19th century, there's a little bit of a political cast to it. We have the Democratic Republicans, the Jeffersonians versus the Federalists, the Hamiltonians. And it becomes known, more well known, that Jefferson was the primary author. And so it gets a little bit of a political kick. But by that time, by the 1790s, you know, it's 15, 20 years later, you start seeing 4th of July celebrations becoming very common, very popular. And you start seeing toasts. They drank a lot at the time. You know, the celebration meant getting the whiskey and out, and they would have toasts. You know, we'll have 13 toasts for the 13 colonies, and you can think about having 13 shots of whiskey. And you know, there'd be toasts to the Declaration of Independence, and then there'd be toasts to the immortal Jefferson and his Declaration of Independence. But then, into the 19th century and into our day, people, different groups, as I said, start latching onto it. South American countries that are trying to get independent from Spain and Portugal start using Jefferson's Declaration of Independence. Women, I mentioned at Seneca Falls, they create the Women's Declaration of Independence. All men and women are created equal. As I said, I think Jefferson probably understood that part. Frederick Douglass, in his, you know, famous July 4th oration, What Matters July 4th to a Black Man? Talks about the Declaration of Independence. You know, so by today, by our time, over 100 countries, in their own constitutive documents or in their own declarations of independence, have taken language out of the American Declaration of Independence. They've taken Thomas Jefferson's language and used it in their own documents. And they recognize it. My favorite is Martin Luther King. Martin Luther King Jr. says the Declaration of Independence is a promissory note to America, a promissory note, a promise of what America can be. So we were talking a moment ago about, well, how does Jefferson write all men are created equal? They weren't treating women equally. They weren't treating Native Americans. They weren't treating African Americans. Well, Martin Luther King is saying in the 1960s, we're still not living up to that promise, but the Declaration is a promise of what we can be. So it grows over time. Almost immediately the soldiers, but then African Americans, then South American nations, then women and other nations begin to use this American creed. So that today, and to some extent, you're ruined by your own success. I've said a couple of times, we forget how revolutionary this was. We forget how significant it was to say governments derive their power from the consent of the government. We're one people across our ethnic and religious differences. It's almost been used so much that we lose that scintillating value of it.
Well, you've described beautifully the growing power of the Declaration through the centuries. But one thing I'd like to double back to, and I do cover in the book, which is he was pretty ticked off about how they had edited his declaration. He made copies and sent them to his friends to say, look, my first draft was so much better.
So much better. Yeah, Jefferson has a thin skin, and he does this repeatedly. My wife is actually a guide at Monticello, and she points out you don't want to cross Jefferson. He'll remember, forever that you crossed him. He does the same thing, by the way, with the Virginia Statute for Religious Freedom. Fundamentally important document in separation of church and state. They make minor edits to his document. He takes his original and sends it to Europe. And so they're actually printing Jefferson's original rather than the one that gets drafted, that gets adopted. And the same thing happens with the Declaration. He sends that around Paris when he's in Paris, and people are using his original. He's pretty thin-skinned. The key difference is he complains about the language. You and I are used to having people edit our stuff.
Well,
We're now
not to say we welcome it.
no, but you get over it. Jefferson never quite got over it. The biggest edit, which is worth mentioning and touching on, is there was a paragraph about slavery, in which he condemns slavery and he blames the King of England for slavery. And I think he gets criticized too heavily. People say that's ridiculous. The King of England wasn't responsible for slavery, which is true. The Americans had certainly embraced slavery. They were making money off of slavery. He was, you don't build a brick home on top of a mountain by yourself. He was using those enslaved people to do it. People say Jefferson had a wonderful garden. Well, he wasn't the one out there gardening. But he was pointing out that there had been efforts. Very initial efforts to stop the slave trade, to permit manumission in some of the American colonies, and Britain had always blocked it. The king had blocked it for economic reasons. But the real problem was South Carolina, Georgia, in particular, and again, Rhode Island and Connecticut and New York are making money off of the slave trade. They say, we just can't say that. We just can't say that. And so that gets expunged. And later, you're mentioning the Patrick Henry, I won't justify it. Jefferson likes to say, well, see, I was always anti-slavery. I didn't do anything about it, but I was always anti-slavery. So that's one of the changes that he's very upset about. The other significant change is he had a fairly pointed attack on British citizens for. You British citizens have failed in your duty to convince Parliament and the King to stop this persecution. And the Continental Congress took that out. They said, look, we may need those British citizens, which in fact happens. I mean, how does the war end? The King wants to keep fighting. Of course, he doesn't care. He's not the one getting bloody. You need the British people, you need the British businessmen, you need the British members of Parliament saying, okay, enough of this. And so, probably wisely, Congress had taken out the insults that Jefferson had thrown at the British people. But yeah, he does this all the time. He says, my draft was better, and that's the one I'll spread around.
Well, okay, we are now officially 250 years after. What does the Declaration mean to us? What should we think it means?
It's I pause. One could give a very quick answer to that, but I think the key thing to understand, maybe some of the discussion we've been having about how aspirational it is. And it wasn't just aspirational in their time, it's aspirational in our time. They were very cognizant. Maybe a theme in this discussion we've been having is there are things that they were very cognizant of. They realized is very real that we've forgotten. And one of those is that a democracy can be unstable, that republics had failed. And we haven't talked much about the Constitution. You know, James Madison drafts the Constitution. He studies what happened in all of these other republics, all of these other democracies that have failed over time. And one of the critical elements is people need to participate. Governments derive their just power from the consent of the governed. That's us. We're the governed. All men are created equal. Well, are we doing that? We are one people across our differences. What unites us is more important than what divides us. And so how much that document at that time and still today is aspirational, something we have to work on. But it's timeless. And that's the difference with the Constitution. We haven't talked much about the Constitution. They understood the Constitution was a law and they thought it was going to be amended all the time. We probably have not amended it as much as they thought it was going to be amended. That was a law that needed to be changed based on conditions. The Declaration, those are principles, those are timeless.
Well, that resonates a lot, and I think, frankly, particularly as you talk about the fragility of a republic, the fragility of a democracy, those are ideas that are very vibrant today, and I think people are especially sensitive to it and alarmed, and we are right to be alarmed. John, this has been a great conversation. I've enjoyed it a lot and learned a lot. Thank you very much.
Oh, David, always a pleasure.
And we'll catch you up down the road.
Thank you.
Awesome. What an interesting jump back into history, and it's so present today. So many themes 250 years later. So thank you to you beautiful historians. We really appreciate hearing this on the David O. Stewart Show. This is our September 2026 episode 4, where we're unpacking The Democracy We Must Keep by David Stewart. So I'm Hope Katz Gibbs, proud producer of the show on Incandescent Radio, Incandescent TV, and check us out on Spotify, Apple, and iHeartRadio. We will see you all next month. Thank you, David. Thank you, John. Be well.